Well, God, let him rip. My name's Bob Darrow. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
And I'm sober today only through the grace and power of God and the program, People and Principles, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank the committee for all the work they put into this convention. I've had a great weekend. I got here and got a fruit basket when I got here, and I've been driving all day and I hadn't stopped to eat. And I got it to the room and tore it. I'm still picking the cellophane out of my teeth, you know. My blood sugar was so low. It was a great thing to have that here. I'd like to thank Wes for asking me to come down here and share. I've known Wes for a while, and Wes is one of the doers in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's involved in everything behind the scenes. He sponsors a lot of guys. He opens his home up, people in AA. He's possibly one of the most humble, honest, thought-worthy people in Alcoholics Anonymous in the desert, and you people don't really appreciate him. Okay. I'd also like to thank Harold, because I was told Harold pays people that mention his name from the podium. I really want to welcome anybody that's real new. I don't need to be a comedian. You had Jimmy Caesar last night.
Don't look at me.
I'm not looking at him. That was a great show. If you're new, I want to welcome you. I'm real glad you're here. I'm just curious, how many people are here within their first year of sobriety? Wow. I'm glad you're here. Thanks. I didn't do that to embarrass you. I just wanted to know how many people here, this is their first year of sobriety, so I know who I'm talking to. I think I'm an alcoholic from the word go. I think that I was an alcoholic before I ever took a drink. I was kind of like a freeze-dried alcoholic, waiting for alcohol. I'll tell you a little story about me. When I was about this little kid, maybe 3 or 4 years old, I was living in Pennsylvania with my parents, and I didn't come from an alcoholic home. I came from a almost an Ozzie and Harriet kind of family. I always knew I was loved. My parents treated me very well. They doted on me. They gave me anything that was in their power to give me. They always told me they loved me, and I could know intellectually that they did, but there was something about me that I couldn't feel it. And I remember as a little kid, one Sunday afternoon, going with them to this farmer's market out in the country, and it's where all the farmers bring their produce and everything, and it's a Sunday afternoon, and on the way there, my dad and mom are talking, and I'm hearing my dad telling my mom about this horseradish that he's going to get, and it's real hot, and it's won all these awards, and he's bragging on this horseradish about how powerful it is, and he's going to go in there and get this farmer to grind it up for him and get a couple jars of it. And they get some, and on the way home, I'm hearing him brag on it all day, I want some. And I ask him for some, and he told me, he says, no, Rob, you can't have any, you're too young, it's powerful, you wouldn't like it. And I'm one of those kind of people by nature that if you tell me I can't have something, I just really want it. I may not even have wanted it until you tell me I can't have it, and then I just gotta have it. And I bid my time and waited till my parents weren't around, and I snuck in the refrigerator, and I got that jar of horseradish, got a big spoon. I remember sitting on the floor of the kitchen, sticking that spoon in there and putting that in my mouth. And I think I saw God. I'm not sure. There was snot pouring out of my nose. There were tears are running down my face. I spewed horseradish all over that kitchen. I was miserable and sick and awful. And that was an awful lot of years ago, and I have not once sat with a big spoon and a jar of horseradish, didn't have to go to no rehab, watch no Father Martin movies, get no sponsor, go no to goddamn meetings, work no steps. But I also got to tell you something else, that if that horseradish would have made me feel and did for me what alcohol did for me, I'd have spent the rest of my life making myself sick with that stuff every chance I could get. And that's because I'm an alcoholic. I was born with what the book calls a spiritual malady. There was something missing inside of me. And I tell you, I didn't understand it for a long time. And in my first probably 10 years or so of sobriety, one of the preoccupations we would have in Denny's is we'd sit around and ponder the big philosophical questions of why are we alcoholic and how come they're not alcoholic and what, you know, all that. You know how you do that all. Eventually it doesn't matter anymore. And I did that for years and wondering how come my mom and dad aren't alcoholic? How come my sister to this day has one and a half margaritas and says stuff like, that's all, I don't want any more? How come, I've heard fifth steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, how come people that come from homes where they have alcoholic parents that were tortured and beaten and sexually molested turned out to be alcoholics, and their brothers and sisters who went through the same thing didn't, to this day can have one or two social drinks? How come people came from really nice homes like me, my sister's not an alcoholic and I am? What's the deal? And a few years ago, a bunch of us in AA, a couple of the guys I sponsor and a couple other people, went to a movie. I went to see this movie. It was called Just Cause. And it was with Sean Connery. And there's a scene in the movie where Sean Connery is in this prison and he's interviewing this wacko serial killer. This guy is so nuts, they got him handcuffed to a table. He's crazy. And he's ranting and raving, and he's telling Sean Connery, he says, yeah, they had doctors in here examining my brain and blood chemistry, trying to figure out why I do what I do. They had psychiatrists in here probing around about my childhood, seeing if somebody made me the way I am. Why do I do the things I do? And he starts this maniacal laugh, and he says, what they'll never understand is some people are just born with a hunger. And I'm sitting in that movie and with a bunch of guys in AA, and we just kind of turned and looked at each other. Went, wow. Some people are just born with a hunger. And I, for as far back as I can remember, there was something missing inside of me. There was something I hungered for, and I didn't even know what it was until I found alcohol. And when I found alcohol, I found the thing that did for me what I desperately needed to have done for me. For the first time in my life, I found something that made me feel the way you look. And it was incredible. And I could never get enough. And that's part of alcoholism. Alcoholism is a disease of chronic malcontent. We're in people that are insatiable by nature. I have never once in my whole drinking career ever, people tell me I drank too much. I never even drank enough. I never once, it was in a bar and the bartender would come along and say, you want another one? I'd say, no, you know, this is just right. I've never been there. I don't know what it's like to be at that spot. I don't know what it's like to be in that spot in any other area of my life. I've never been to a point in my drunk or sober where I've ever really honestly inside myself, if I thought about it, was satisfied with my relationship with God, my own personal growth, my friendships, my character defects, how much money I have, how much love I have in my life. I've never got to, there's always a part of me, and it's not that at times I don't feel whole, and it's not like Wes says, I've never had it so good. That's absolutely true. I have never had it so good. But there's always like this thing inside of me that would like a little more. And I think that's what it's like to have alcoholism. Once I take alcohol out of the picture, I was under an illusion for a lot of years in Alcoholics Anonymous that maybe I would finally, maybe after 10 years, and then I got to 10 years, and it wasn't 10 years. Well, maybe it's 15 years. I got to 15 years. Maybe it's 20. That someday in AA, I was going to do the real four step, you know, not like those other ones, or I was going to have the surrender, the surrender. I mean, the surrender that after it was done, I kind of glow in the dark, you know, that kind of and I would get to a point where I would feel absolutely whole once and for all. Never be malcontent again. Never feel like there's something missing. And I've come to understand in Alcoholics Anonymous that doesn't happen to guys like me. It may happen to some people here, but it doesn't happen to me. I was back at Stepping Stones, the place that Bill lived for most of his sobriety, that wrote a lot of the AA literature. And I was doing the tour, and I got real friendly with Paul, who's the archivist back there. And Paul told me a story that blew my mind. Paul said, when Bill was sober about 20 years, now I'm going to try this, I may get this a little wrong because I'm passing on something that was passed on to me. But what I heard Paul say, that when Bill was sober about 20 years, he was having a conversation with his spiritual advisor at the time, which is Father Ed Dowling. And this is after Bill came through all the depressions and everything. And Bill is saying to Ed, he's saying, Ed, you know, my life's never been better, but there's something still missing. And it drives me sometimes. And I still don't feel like I work with enough newcomers. And I still don't feel that my relationship with God is good enough. I still don't feel like I can love good enough. I feel that there's still something missing. And I don't know what it is. And Father Ed Dowling looked at him and he says, Bill, he says, you got to understand that every once in a while, God gives his greatest blessing to some of his kids. And it's what we in the clergy call divine dissatisfaction. And it's a blessing because it drives you, pushes you, shoves you, and drags you screaming into being more than what you are. And I am an alcoholic of the divine dissatisfaction type. And I am in love with that today. I am glad I'm that way. I would not want to be the kind of person that could say with any area of my life, this is enough. Enough growth. Enough love. Enough newcomers. I am hungry, and I am still hungry today. I'm hungry for more. And in the hands of Alcoholics Anonymous and God, that's not such a bad deal. I started drinking when I was 12 years old, and I'm the guy they talk about in the Big Book. I was an alcoholic from the first drink. Dr. Silkworth says that we are people who have a physiological allergy to alcohol. But unlike allergies, say if you're allergic to strawberries and you break out in hives, Silkworth says we don't break out in hives, we break out in what he calls a phenomenon of craving. And I was a relapser in Alcoholics Anonymous in the early 70s, and I was in and out of meetings of AA, and I sat in rooms and listened sometimes because I was desperate trying to get some kind of answer. Didn't work the steps, I just listened, but I sat here and I'd heard people talk about this phenomenon of craving. And I would look at my life and my drinking and I couldn't see that I was a victim of a craving. I get drunk, I mean, yeah, but so do the guy, everybody I drink with drinks like that. I mean, it's, you know, and Silkworth says after a while we cannot differentiate the true from the false. Our alcoholic life seems the only normal one, and it seemed normal to me. And the funny thing about a craving is that you don't realize you have it until it's interrupted. That's why there's a test in chapter 3. It says if you don't think you're an alcoholic, try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and then stop abruptly. Well, I mean, I might try that test, but after one or two drinks, I'm going to become real clear to me that this is not a good test day. I mean, this is not the day to take the test. I mean, it's a valid test, but I'm not going to take it right now. I mean, you know, and I could never complete a test like that. I would just, it'd be ridiculous. So I had to go back into my life and see when my drinking was interrupted. And it was very rare because I was one of those kind of alcoholics. I protected that at great lengths. I was the kind of guy that, in high school, before I even thought I had a drinking problem, if you would have invited me over to your house on a Sunday afternoon to watch football, and there's two or three of us sitting there, and you have a six-pack of beer, and that's all you have, and I'm going to be there all day, and you said, do you want to have a beer? No. No thanks. I won't do that to myself. Now, I don't know about phenomenon of craving or any of that stuff. I just intuitively knew not to do that. You had a stack of cases about this high. I'm there. I'm with you. And I did that all my life. I protected myself. I always made sure there was a supply, or I always had a game plan. When I was drinking, when I'm finishing up, halfway through one bottle, I'm thinking about the next. I was always that way. And I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one day, and I'm listening to a woman share her experience, and I have learned everything I know about me from listening to you. I have a seemingly inability at times to learn anything real about myself from direct examination. Because when I try to look inside myself to see what's wrong or what's going on, I can't see it because what I'm looking for, I'm looking with. And all I come up, I'm so full of rationalizations and justifications and defense mechanisms that it's very difficult for me to do that. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, the beauty of AA for me has always been that no one in AA has ever tried to tell me what I was. Because I defend myself against that. It's my nature. So in AA, you tell me about yourself and you're not talking about me and I'm sitting there identifying. And I'm going, wow, I'm like that. And I'm listening to this woman talk about her drinking career and about the phenomenon of craving. And a light went on. And I remembered all of a sudden an incident that happened to me when I was 18 years old. Now, when I was 18 years old, there was no way I was an alcoholic. Matter of fact, I went from 18 to early 20s, maybe 21, 22, I was in my better living through chemistry phase of alcoholism. I was the hippie and the long hair and all that stuff. So there's no way in my mind I'm an alcoholic. And this gal that I'm dating, her family wanted to meet me, so they invited me over to her parents' house for dinner. And it was going to be a long ordeal all night. I don't like stuff like that, but I'm trying to be a good guy, and I went. And they had a bottle of wine with dinner. And I drink quickly. I don't know why. Evaporation's probably a childhood issue or something. I don't know. But I drink with a sense of urgency, and I drink quickly. And because I drink quickly, I get two glasses out of that bottle of wine. They're still drinking their first glass and talking. And I'm done the second glass, and I'm sitting there and getting a little uncomfortable. The bottle's empty, and I don't know anything about alcoholism, phenomenon of craving, just getting a little antsy. I finally blurted out. I said, boy, that was good wine. Do you have any more? They said, no, nope, sorry. And they went back to talking. I'm sitting there, and I'm getting a little more uptight. And I don't know what's going on. I'm getting, you know, kind of antsy and squirrely, and my head's going faster and faster. And I finally blurted out. I said, I like beer. Well, that's not, Bob, we don't have any beer. And they went back to talking about Vietnam and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. And I'm sitting there, and I my head is going nuts. And they're yammering on about this insignificant stuff. And part of me is getting angry because they're just talking this nonsense. And another part of me feels guilty for being mad at them because they're so nice to me. And I'm just going nuts. And I finally excuse myself from the table, and I go to the bathroom, and I lock the door, and like a crazed animal, I went through all the cabinets in there. I found this bottle of cough medicine. It was like 35% alcohol with codeine and terpenhydrate. I remember taking the top off of that, taking a big hit off of it, and it was like, phew, there's hope. It's like, I remember chugging that bottle of cough medicine down, and all of a sudden, everything in my mind got real focused. All the voices had a singleness of purpose, and it was to get out of there, right? And I went back out to the dinner table, and I had this story about this thing that I forgot to take care of, and I was very gracious about it, and I'm so sorry I have to leave. I really wanted to stay all night, and et cetera, et cetera. We must do this again. I went and I got in my car, and I drove like a gentleman 20, 25 miles an hour to the end of their street, and then I drove like 90 miles an hour like a crazed maniac over to a guy's house who had a bar in the basement because I had two glasses of wine. Now, I was the only alcoholic at that dinner table. Those other people had been alcoholics. We'd all been in that damn bathroom looking through those cabinets. But something happens to me that does not happen to people who don't have alcoholism. And it never will happen to them. And that's what that Silkworth says, that this phenomenon of craving differentiates us and sets us apart as an entity. My sister will never have it. Nobody else will ever have it. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978, and I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew I had that phenomenon of craving. But I secretly suspected that surely everybody that drinks must get that more feeling. They got to get that. Silkworth says they don't. Silkworth says they never experienced that. And I didn't realize that that was true. I thought that they just, for some reason, the guys that I used to drink with, that we'd go go to the bar, and then they would go home, just seemed to be able to control themselves more than I could. And it's not a matter of control for them at all. And I was about 4.5 years sober, and I'm dating a gal that's not an alcoholic, and I finally saw through watching her, a non-alcoholic drink, I saw the difference. And it brought it home to me. And this gal and I would go out to dinner, and she'd order a drink. I swear to God, it would take her a half hour to drink one drink. I mean, she would sip and then talk for 10 minutes. I'd sit there and I'd just watch the ice melt. You know, I mean, that's like alcohol abuse, you know? She'd order another drink, and I never, the whole time I dated this gal, never saw her finish two whole drinks. I saw her finish 1.5, 1 2/3, 1 1/4. She'd always, after into the second drink, push it aside and say the most unbelievable thing you've ever heard. She'd say, "I don't want any more. I'm starting to feel it." It would be easier for me as an alcoholic to have sex and after two strokes say, "I don't want any more of that. I'm starting to feel it," than it would be to do that with two drinks of alcohol. And I started to realize that I really am bodily and mentally different from those people. See, my friend who's not an alcoholic was not trying to prove a point to me. We're all capable of that. We've all done that. We've all gone out to a bar with our folks or our lover or our boss and who's been on our back about our drinking, and to show them we can have two and walk away. Can't do it a lot. We can do it a little bit. My friend wasn't trying to prove nothing to me. When she took two drinks, she gets a feeling like she's losing control. I take two drinks, I get a feeling like I'm getting control, right? Alcohol does something for me that it doesn't do for her. And it doesn't do it for my mom when she was alive. It doesn't do it for my sister. But it does it for me. And that's why I'm an alcoholic. That coupled with the spiritual malady, the physical allergy and the spiritual malady, is a disease that Chuck used to talk about. It's a trap we cannot spring. And I, in the early 1970s, I started getting a lot of trouble with alcoholism, and I started hitting the institutions. And in the institutions, I started being introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my life was a mess. And I'm one of those kind of guys that you take alcohol out of my life and you put me in an AA meeting surrounded by happy, enthusiastic people, and I don't like happy, enthusiastic people when I'm sober. I mean, I don't even like people when I'm sober. And everybody in AA is glad to see me. Oh, you don't even know me. I mean, and if you did, you wouldn't let me know where you lived, because I didn't know what you were. You were like a cross between the Salvation Army and Amway. I mean, some kind, you know, it's the bizarre deal here. And I would sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have talked to hundreds and hundreds of newcomers over the years, and I sat in meetings and came to the same conclusion that so many new people come to in AA. Yes, my life is a mess. I am in a lot of trouble here. I don't have the courage to kill myself. I'm stuck. I know alcohol has something to do with it because I keep getting arrested and it involves alcohol. But I am not like you people in AA, because I stopped drinking and I don't feel like you look. And it seemed to me that everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous came to AA, they quit drinking, and they were grateful for everything. They quit drinking and they loved everybody. They quit drinking and their life just soared into some kind of success emotionally and mentally and materially. And I quit drinking and I felt like a fish out of water. I quit drinking and abstinence felt like I was doing time. I love W.C. Fields. He says, "I was sober one time. It was the most boring 45 minutes of my life." I'm one of those alcoholics that for all practical purposes, my alcoholism starts where the bottle in the bag ends. And it's the insanity that is brought on to me by the emptiness of my and desolation of my own abstinence that drives me so insane that I will eventually pick up something I have sworn to myself I will never touch again, that I know with every fabric of my being will destroy me, and I will pick it up anyway. And I'll pick it up knowing it's going to destroy me. And I'll pick it up because I'll be so overwhelmed by the way I feel in this state of abstinence that I will feel that if I don't do something to change the way I feel right now, I am going to lose my mind. And some of my insanity is that I will pick up a drink knowing what's going to happen to me. I picked up a drink when I was on paper. And to pick up a drink means I'm going to be violated. I picked up a drink when I was living in a halfway house in winter with no other place to go. And there's snow on the ground. And to pick up a drink means I'm out in the snow once again and I may freeze to death. And I would pick up a drink. I would hold out as long as I could. I would not pick up a drink day in, week out, month in, month out. Screw this. And it never seemed to get any better. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and it's all you happy people and all you do is point out in stark relief everything I'm not. And in AA, I always had this awful, sick, lonely feeling like it was all of you and then there is me. Separate and different and apart from. And I know what it's like to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and die of untreated alcoholism. And sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, the one place on the face of the earth where I should feel the most connected and the most a part of, and sit there and feel like I'm dying of loneliness. At least once a year I hear about a guy or somebody I've met in AA that commits suicide. It's not an unusual story. Talks about it twice in the book, about making the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. A lot of alcoholics commit suicide. And I was at the verge of that many times, and I'd be willing to bet that right 10 seconds before they finally did themselves in, if you would grab them and ask them why they're doing this, what is killing you, they would never say alcoholism. Most of them would say, I'm dying of loneliness. Because this is a disease of loneliness. The book says that we get to a point where we know a loneliness such as few do. And it's that sickness that happens to guys like me once alcohol stops being a treatment for alcoholism. See, alcohol, for a lot of years, was the answer. Alcohol, for a lot of years, did what Alcoholics Anonymous does. I remember walking into bars in my early days of drinking. Locked up inside myself, frustrated with life. I can't talk to anybody. I have one of those get away from me attitudes. Lonely, not fitting anywhere. Like I'm going to go out of my mind. Like there's a scream in me that wants to come out and never stop. Have 5 shots of Jack Daniels and I can come out and play. 5 shots of Jack Daniels and I can look around the bar and kind of love people. 5 shots of Jack Daniels and I can open up. I can tell you about me. I can listen to you and be concerned about you. 5 shots of Jack Daniels was a treatment for my alcoholism. But alcoholism is a disease of diminishing returns. In the beginning, when I first started drinking, it was all this incredible good feeling and a lot of fun, a little bit of dues. And as time went on, the teeter-totter shifted. And at the end, there's no more fun in it. There's no more relief. There's no more feeling like I'm a part of. And my life is such a mess and I'm buried in such crap I can't dig my way out. And at the end of my drinking, I'm not the guy. Alcohol is no longer a treatment for alcoholism. At the end of my drinking, I'm not the guy that's in some Skid Row bar drinking and laughing and talking to the girls and shooting pool. I'm the guy that's sitting over in the corner drinking all by himself, drinking himself into oblivion, sometimes crying because I feel so stuck. and so awful and so ashamed of myself. Looking out at the people in the bar that are having fun and carrying on and laughing and wondering, what's wrong with me? Why can't I get that anymore? And inside me, it just would break my heart because I would hunger with everything in me for the effects of alcohol that they're obviously still getting that I just can't get anymore. And by the end of my drinking, that's what happened. Alcohol stopped being an effective treatment for alcoholism. But yet, I couldn't stop. Because I would stop drinking and the emptiness and desolation of abstinence was so overwhelming that I was in that vicious cycle where I would drink in loneliness and despair and self-pity, and I would get sober in frustration and loneliness and separateness until I couldn't stand abstinence anymore, and I would pick up a drink and I would go until I couldn't stand that anymore. I ran out of money or I was arrested to enter back into abstinence. And it's no wonder guys like me start thinking like, I'm going to kill myself. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I don't fit here. I drink and hope to find camaraderie and go down to the park or go with the guys on passing bottles of wine around or go into some Skid Row bar hoping to find that sense of camaraderie and connectedness I'd found once in places like that, and I don't find it there anymore. And I live in abject loneliness. And at the end of my drinking, when I started thinking about offing myself, it wasn't because of the shame and the guilt and the things I did to my family. And I did some horrible things to my family. I adjust to that. I adjust to the homelessness, and I adjust to doing time in jail and getting my nose broke, and I adjust to selling blood and prostitute myself in gay bars for $4 or $5 so I can get a half gallon of wine. I adjust to having wet pants. I adjust to all that. What brought me to the point of desperation that I wanted to commit suicide, didn't have the courage to do it, and ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous the last time, was that I had nowhere to go. Alcohol stopped working. I couldn't live. It talks about it in the book. It says we get to a point where we can't imagine life with it, and we can't imagine life without it. We will know a loneliness such as few do. We'll be at the jumping off place and we'll wish for the end. And in 1978, that's what brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been around AA for a long time, many years, since probably 7 years, in and out of institutions, in and out of AA meetings. The year before, the year, probably 8 months prior to my last drunk, my second to last drunk, I busted out of a halfway house with another guy, went on this tear. While he's passed out in his trailer, I borrowed his car and his wallet to get some more beer. Got arrested for a felony, hit and run, DUI, and a stolen car. Spent 3.5 months in jail because homeless people can't make bail. Went before a judge. He sentenced me to 2 years in the state penitentiary. And gave me a break. He says, we're going to stay the commitment. The probation and parole office said, you can go into this place called the Ark House on the north side of Pittsburgh. You can stay there for 1 year. And you get a job, make the restitution, pay the court costs, get good UAs, good PO report, do everything you're supposed to do. You come back right in front of me on this date a year from now. And if you're everything's square, you won't have to do the 2 years. But if you cannot carry out any of those conditions, it's automatic. You're done. So I go, here I am. I'm desperate. I go into this place called the Ark House. And I tell you, if sincerity and determination was enough to overcome alcoholism, I'd have got sober years before I did. But see, lack of power is my dilemma. And I went into that place, and I wanted to stay sober with everything in me. Winter's coming on. There's snow on the ground. I have nowhere else to go. I pick up a drink. Until the police find me and put me in prison for 2 years, I'm going to be living in the snow. And I don't want to do that. I've done that. I've walked all night long in those cities back east when you're homeless because you can't sit down. Because if you sit down, you fall asleep. So I'm in this place and I'm hanging on by my fingernails. And the emptiness and desolation of my alcoholism is getting so intense. It's coming. A drink is coming at me. I can see it. And I'm putting it off and one day at a time. How many, you know, My great fear is that AA had good news and bad news. The good news is if I went to 10 meetings a day, I might stay sober the rest of my life. And the bad news, I'm going to live a long time. And I'm hanging on by my fingernails. And I did something I'd never done before. After a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in this Skid Row halfway house or whatever it is, I grab an old timer in AA and I says, I need to talk to somebody. Please, I need help. And the guy sits down with me after the meeting and I start telling him about everything. I tell him about the 2 years in prison, telling him about how I tried to tell him how I felt. I couldn't put it into words. I just said, you know, I don't know what's wrong with me. I go these emotional swings that one minute I feel great and the next minute I'm almost suicidally depressed and nobody even does anything to me. It just happens. It's just, I'm crazy. I got all these weird thoughts in my head. They won't stop. I just think the most bizarre stuff you wouldn't imagine. All these little voices in my head. See, for a guy like me, you take alcohol out of my life and it's living with my mind is like driving in a van cross country full of 8-year-olds that have overdosed on sugar and none of them like you. And I got all these little... And it's all fear stuff. It's all, Bob, what if? Bob, what makes you think? Bob, blah, 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 blah. I'm telling him about how ashamed of myself I feel for the things I did to my mom and dad who loved me very much. And I'm telling him about my inability to stay sober. I've been in and out of this thing for several years and I just can't. I'm at my wit's end. And I says, I need help. And he gives me his phone number and he says, Bob, if he points to the thing on the wall with the 12 steps and he says, if you'll do those, these problems will take care of themselves. And he gets up and he moves over, goes over to the coffee thing. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, man, I've seen these steps before. I better really read them this time. And I'm sitting there and I'm reading them. And after really reading them and getting through them, he comes back and sits down. And it occurs to me that this guy has not heard anything I have just told him. There is nothing in these 12 steps that corresponds to one of the problems I just told him about. Nothing. There's not even in, you stretch your imagination very far, there's nothing here that has anything to do with that stuff. I need a set of steps, like step one, make Bob's police record disappear. Step two, make his parents realize how wrong they'd been about him. Step three, give him $1,000. Step four, get him a job. Step five, bring her back, properly ashamed of herself. Step six, just make him feel like the people in AA look. I always thought, if my life was like yours, I could do what you do. I would not drink too, but my case is different. You don't understand how I feel. You don't understand there's something else wrong with me. Drinking's not just the deal with me. There's something else wrong. I don't know. And I've been to therapy. I spent my parents in my teens and early 20s until they cut me off, spent a fortune sending me to some of the best psychiatrists in the country. I thought, well, geez, I came from a nice family, but, you know, somebody must have damaged me somewhere because I felt damaged, you know? And I went through hypnotherapy because I couldn't come up with anything. And they took me back and because I thought there must be some instance in my childhood where mom wouldn't, maybe she didn't let me have a pony or something, you know? It just scarred me. I'd go back in my childhood under therapy and we'd deal with that and I just like a kid's toy balloon that's let loose. I'd soar into mental health. And I spent years doing that and there's nothing back there. Alcoholism has nothing to do with any of that. This spiritual malady I have has nothing to do with any of that stuff. And this guy's telling me about these steps and man, that's not it. That can't be it. And so I never finished. I never tried them. See, one of my problems that I face as an alcoholic, I go on a run. Alcohol strips me down to the bone. It takes everything away from me. It rips out my self-respect. Then when there's nothing left, I come back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first thing I get back is my damn opinion. And it is my opinion and my judgment that kept me from doing this stuff. Because I got to think about it. And it talks about that in the book, one of the funniest lines in AA. Now, it spends all these pages talking about alcoholism, the fatal malady.
And then it says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death. I got an alcoholic death over here. Or to live by spiritual principles are not always easy alternatives to face. It's like, you go into a cancer ward, people dying of cancer, and you say, if you'll do these spiritual principles, you can live a normal, happy life. They would be on their knees begging you to tell them. I go into a Skid Row detox where people are dying of alcoholism twice a week. And you present these spiritual principles to them. You ask them if they want to come out, go to a step workshop or some meetings, or do AA, get a sponsor. And it's almost like they say, well, tell me about that alcoholic death again. What kind of spiritual principles? I'm busy now, you know. That's alcoholism. It's the only disease I know of that if you have it, it uses your own mind against you. And the sad part about that is if you're like I am, when I'm afraid and I'm empty and I don't feel very good about myself, the first place I always retreat to is my head. I go up into the control room and I put the stuff on the screen that's threatening, and I plan scenarios and what I'll say to that person and then what they'll say to me. And I'd be better off getting Charles Manson as a spiritual advisor than going up here. So here I am, I'm in this Skid Row halfway house. I'm presented with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm given a phone number, and this guy is willing to take me through these steps. And I turned around and walked away from him. It was almost like if you were to go down to wherever you live, whatever town you live in, there's a homeless section where people live on the streets. And you were walking down this through this homeless section, and some old man with matted down, greasy, dirty hair and dirty clothes crawls out from under a bush. And he asks you for a quarter, and you give him a quarter, and he says, you know, I like you. I'm going to give you $10 million. And he reaches inside his third inner coat and pulls out this grubby check he's obviously stolen from somewhere, and he writes out this check for $10 million, and he gives it to you. If you're like I am by nature, you're going to walk away, and when he's not looking, I mean, you know, you're going to tear it up and you're going to throw it away. He's a bum, $10 million. Except the check's good. And in 1978, I got so desperate and so stuck in my own alcoholism that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the last time on the end of my last run, and I came here willing to cash the check. I came here in a state of desperation where I was willing to take some actions that made absolutely no sense to me. And if you're new, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't make sense. If you get sober like most of us get sober, you get sober with a lot of problems. And it makes more sense to attack the problems. And if I get the problems squared away and my life in order, hey, then I could go to AA. Then I could work those steps. Then I could help people. And I got to tell you, if you wait to do that approach, you will die of alcoholism. And in 1978, coming out of a detox center, a guy grabbed me after a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he told me, he made me a promise that I'll never forget. He says, I promise you that if you put as much time and energy into Alcoholics Anonymous as you used to put in to trying to stay loaded and run the universe, that all these unresolved problems will take care of themselves. And that was my day of commitment. And when he said that to me inside myself, I just threw up my hands. I said, okay. If I do nothing the rest of my life except play hearts in the back of the Thai club with a bunch of old men, if my life never gets any better, if I just don't have to go back, if I don't have to sober up one more time, maybe it ain't such a bad deal. Maybe it's not such a bad deal. And I, you know, the Buddhists say when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And I fell into the hands of some members of a group called the Floating Big Book Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's my home group today. And I fell into their hands because they were the people who did all the hospital and institution meetings in Las Vegas. And they were the people that devoted the most, they gave their most important thing that they have, their time, to guys like me. And I joined that home group and I got a sponsor, and I was encouraged to start forming certain habits in my life that would eventually change my life, and they were things that didn't make any sense. Like praying. I didn't believe in God. Matter of fact, I was raised a Catholic. I kind of was under the impression that if there is a God, I am probably in a lot of trouble. I mean, I remember they taught me about a God that existed to judge me, right? That's all he did. And he could see in the dark. That's not a good deal for a guy like me. That's a bad, bad thing. He could read my mind. And I'm always thinking stuff I'm not supposed to be thinking. The nuns used to say, Robert, you got to be pure of thought, word, and deed. And they'd say that in X-rated movies. It just start going through my head. I'd say, oh, don't think that stuff. Oh, I'm going to go to hell. Oh, it's going to burn me. It's going to be awful. So I come to a conclusion. As a little kid, there's no God. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and people tell me to pray. And I was lucky enough to get desperate enough to do something that made no sense to me. And I started getting down on my knees. And as it was told to me, they said, we know you don't believe in God. We want you to ask whoever or whatever is running the universe for the help you need to get through this day sober. And then thank that power at the end of the day for that day of sobriety. And I just started doing it. I didn't believe in it. I didn't think it would work. But there's a line in our book. It says, before we ever come to believe in God, we first come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of our life as we'd been living it. And I didn't believe in God, and I don't even know if I believed in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I believed in that. I believed in the hopelessness and futility of my life as I'd been living it. And I came here with a desperation. And I started to do these very simple actions, and I joined this big book group, and we started studying the book, and I started putting the steps into my life. And I didn't even know I was putting the steps into my life until I was sober a couple years. My sponsor got on this kick. He had me reading page 60 through 63 of the big book over and over and over and over. I'd read it. It's the part that talks about the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the scenery. It talks about selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our problem. And I'd read that, go to meetings and look around, and I could see that there were people in my home group that were doing that. It became real clear to me there was some real control freaks in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew why my sponsor had me read that, so I could enlighten them. And it's a tough, lonely business when you know the truth in AA and you got that sense of urgency to tell people. Oddly enough, there's a line in the 12 by 12. It says that we will be quick to see our defects in character, of character in others before we can see them in ourselves. And I could see that you were selfish and self-centered. I could see that you were like the actor who wants to run the whole show. But I couldn't see that it was me, because from the inside of me, looking out, I'm not trying to control nothing. I'm just trying to make things nice. Because I got an excuse and a rationalization and a justification for everything I've ever did, every attitude I've ever had. And even if I don't, give me a minute, I'll come up with one. And I can't see that I'm that way by direct examination. And my sponsor tricked me one day. I was having a bad day. I'm having one of those kind of days where I'm at work and I'm a cashier and the customers are annoying me. Everybody wants help. I get off work, I'm the secretary of this meeting, I have to get some styrofoam cups, I go to the grocery store, I get in the 9 items or less line, there's a woman there with 13 items. And I'm on a mission from God. And I don't do nothing, but in my mind I'm strangling her, you know, I get out in traffic and I'm hurrying to the meeting because I got a new guy that's going to meet me there, you know, and I'm going to fix him, and there's people are driving, trying, I'm going to run this one woman off the road, she's driving below the speed limit, and I get to the meeting, I sit my newcomer right in that chair, I get the literature set up, I get the perfect chairman and co-chairman to do this discussion meeting, the perfect two guys that are going to give my newcomer the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can picture him getting his 1 year cake, mentioning my name. The meeting starts, So I asked for a topic. Some guy starts talking about shooting heroin. Somebody else yells out, "You can't talk about that. This is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." Somebody jumps in to defend the new guy that's talking about drugs. Somebody else defends the other guy. It's like the meeting from hell. If you've ever been to a meeting like I hate meetings like that. I don't know. It wasn't even an AA meeting. I don't know what it was. It was just a bizarre. I'm sitting there. I'm getting mad. My newcomer's not getting the message. It occurs to me I'm the only one in Alcoholics Anonymous that cares about these people. The meeting's over. I throw the literature in the briefcase. I storm out of the meeting, make some snide remark to an old-timer, go home, and like Pavlov's dog, I've been conditioned to call my sponsor. I call him, and he says, "Read page 60 through 63 of the Big Book." I start reading it, and for the first time in my life, it's not Joe and it's not Bill. There I am, the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the scenery. And for the first time in my life, I saw a glimpse of what my problem has always been. There's a line in there that says, "First of all, we had to quit playing God." And my sponsor used to say that to me all the time, and I didn't know what he was talking about. I would go to him with lists of people that are out of line in AA, you know? I mean, she's cheating on her husband, and he's 13-stepping, and he's, you know, all this stuff. Oh, this guy's an egomaniac, and this guy's a materialist. You know, I'd have all these lists. And my sponsor kept saying, he says, you got to quit playing God. I'm not playing God. I'm reporting accurate information here. I'm not playing God. I don't know what you're talking about, playing God. And I couldn't see it, that I'm sitting on a throne of judgment, as if it is my job to take everybody, to know what's wrong with everybody and judge everybody else. And I got to tell you something, over the years, I've come to the conclusion, if there's one thing that will ever take me out of Alcoholics Anonymous, it'll be my judgment. And I have watched people judge their way right out of Alcoholics Anonymous without ever leaving the rooms. I have caught myself doing it many times, and it's a hideous spiritual sickness. And it's so subtle. It starts out with sitting in a meeting and they call, "Oh, don't call on her. Oh, she's going to talk about that goddamn relationship again. Oh, no, not him. He sounds like a Hallmark card in a recovery bookstore. Don't call on him. Don't call on him." By the end of the meeting, they haven't called on you, and you know you're the only one that knows the truth. I mean, right? And what happens is, very slowly, without ever leaving the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I start judging my way right out. I start, they're not, what kind of program is he working? Unlike me. And I think the ISM is that I separate myself and I do it with my judgment. I play God. And that's the sickness of alcoholism. If there's anything that will separate me from you and take me out of here, it'll be that. I've watched guys do that over the years, and it's a sad thing. And they leave. They eventually start backing off on the meetings and start, and to them, they don't see what's happening. Just as like when I get caught up, if I don't go to talk to my sponsor, I don't see that I'm doing that. It appears to me that I'm getting better and you're getting worse. It appears to me that I'm outgrowing you. And the sickness about that is that I'm the guy that's leaving and I can't see it. And I've watched a lot of people drink. I go to a meeting, Skid Row Detox meeting. I do it twice a week. It's one of the best things in Alcoholics Anonymous God's ever put in my path. And there's not a week that goes by I don't see someone in that meeting that's drank with over 10 years of sobriety. And I'm not talking about people who never really got it here. I'm talking about people. I've watched people who were circuit speakers. They drink and they end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. They end up in Skid Row Detox in Las Vegas, because Las Vegas is like a magnet. If you drink and you're from Cincinnati or you're from wherever, you end up in Las Vegas. And I watched them, some of them judge their way right out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only thing that keeps me here and keeps me effective is not the book, it's not my sponsor. It's my willingness to show up and stick my hand out to a new guy on a daily basis and offer myself and my time to someone else to take them through the process which I was taken through, and help them to get connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. I sponsor a lot of guys, and I tell you from the heart, I don't give any of them a chance until they get to one point. I don't care how good of a job they've done on step 4 and 5 and step 8 and 9. Until they start sponsoring other people and start taking other people through the deal and start caring about other people, their sobriety's precarious. And it's the Hindus say that the student doesn't learn the lesson until he becomes the teacher. And I'll tell you something, I've done a lot of inventories for myself, and I've gotten more out of listening to other guys' fifth steps than I've gotten out of doing my own. And Alcoholics Anonymous is based on a spiritual principle that we must give what we want to get. There's a movement that's come into AA the last 15 years or so from treatment centers that try to make Alcoholics Anonymous into a self-help program. It, to me, and my way of thinking, the way I was taught, it is not, was not, and never will be a self-help program. It is a program of self-abandonment. I loved what Tom said last night about working on your character defects. You want to see somebody between 5 and 10 years, they get sick in Alcoholics Anonymous, they decide they're going to work on themselves. And a lot of people leave AA. They decide that I need more sophisticated answers. They go to therapy. Or they'll join a church. If you're sober a while here and you feel a little bit of emptiness and you think something's wrong and you think maybe you need more advanced answers, you need to work on yourself more, I will give you a 2-week experiment that may change your life. Spend the next week doing nothing except thinking about, doing for, and working on you. If you survive that week, spend an entire week doing nothing except living to help other people. And if you have the same spiritual malady that I have, at the end of that second week, you will realize at a gut level what the path that guys like us must walk. There's a line on page 20 in the big book. It says, my very life as an ex-problem drinker depends upon my constant thought of others, their needs, and how I can work for them. Constant. I can't do constant. Who'd they write that for? Al-Anon's constant. I do an hour or so a day. That's pretty good for a guy like me. A guy who's basically goes through life worrying about, I get up in the morning, what's the first thing I do is kind of think about me. Think about my day, my life, my job. Now, the great cry of the alcoholic is, well, all this AA stuff's good, but what about me? And in Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes I think, well, what about you? What about the guys I sponsor? I've set certain disciplines in my life with people that call me and meetings I'm committed to and newcomers I work with, that I create islands in my life on a regular basis where I'm forced by the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous to put myself in a situation for short periods of time. I'm not thinking about me and I'm thinking about you. And that is the treatment of alcoholism. I'm going to share one story and I'm going to quit. When I was 3 years sober, I'd been saying the third step prayer every day for 3 years. And I'm bitching to my sponsor. I says, when is this relieve me of the bondage of self thing going to happen? Because I can say that third step prayer in the morning, and 5 minutes later, I'm in my head worrying about the whole day, you know, just obsessed with myself and my problems and my job and my feelings and me. My sponsor says, well, when I ever meet an alcoholic that no longer has a problem with self-centeredness, I'll buy him a drink. Well, I mean, that's cute, but what's that mean? I couldn't get it. What he's trying to tell me is that there is no permanent once and for all solution to an ongoing problem. That it is my nature to be self-centered. That I have a daily reprieve based on certain spiritual actions I take in my life. And I didn't get it for a long time. And one night I'm at home and I'm sitting on the sofa. I'd been to 2 meetings that day. It's about 9:30 at night, and I'm sitting there and I'm pondering my life. And the more I think about my life and my job and my stuff, the worse it gets. I'm one of those kind of guys, you give me 20 minutes just to think about me, and it's like I start sinking into this abyss. And the more I think about it, the realize that job, I told him in the meeting how great it was. I just, the more I thought about it, I realized how they were taking advantage of me. And I get started realizing other people are getting paid more, and my life's going nowhere. And yeah, one day I'll just be poor, sitting in a rocking chair all by myself, old and decrepit and sick, eating Alpo. I'm sinking into this abyss, you know, this depression. And people in AA, my sponsor and other members of Alcoholics Anonymous conditioned me that when I'm in trouble, when I knew I was in trouble, I'm getting so depressed that to ask God for help, call somebody or go to a meeting. And I asked God for help, and I looked at the clock, and there's a meeting in about 15 or 20 minutes, only a couple blocks from my house. So the Between the Shows group meets at 10:15. And I'm sitting on the sofa, and I don't know if you've ever been in a depression that is so immobilizing you're paralyzed. I can't even get up. And I'm praying to get up. And I finally muscled myself off the sofa like a robot. I go and I get in the car, still up in here, just self-obsessed. The world is so far away. I drive to the meeting. I sit in the back of the meeting. I can't hear anything because I'm in here so much. What you're saying in the meeting, it can't reach me. It's like Muzak in a doctor's office. I'm so up in here, so self-obsessed. And sitting across from me in the back of the room is this guy who I had seen around the Thai club in Vegas. And he'd been sober, I guess, for a while, and he must have gone out on a drunk, and he's really sick. And he's sitting in the back, and he's grabbing himself like this, and he's rocking back and forth like he's going to fly apart. And then he gets up, and he paces back and forth. And then he goes into the bathroom, and you can hear him in there dry heaving. And he's, like, really annoying. I mean, he's just, I mean, I'm trying to figure my life out here, you know? I mean, I got problems, and this guy is just a pain in the butt. The meeting's over. I haven't heard nothing. I'm conditioned to do service, so I'm staying. Charlie's the secretary. I'm helping this guy, Charlie, set the church chairs back up and do all that stuff before we leave. Charlie and I are the last two guys to leave the meeting. We're standing on the front door of the chapel. He's locking it up. My car is parked right there, and the guy that was sitting in the back of the meeting is curled up in a fetal position, laying in front of my car. Now, I'm going to have to step over him to get in my car to go home and think, right? But Charlie's standing there, and if I do that, he's going to tell everybody what a rotten member of Alcoholics Anonymous I am. He's going to get back to my home group and my sponsor, and I'm there, oh, man. And Charlie, he works the graveyard shift. He's on his way to work. He can't help the guy, so I go over, and I start to, what's wrong? He says, I'm going to go into DTs. I'm afraid I'm going to have convulsions. I want to die, and he's crying, and he's wet his pants. I mean, he's just a mess. I says, get in the car, and I take him. At that time in Las Vegas, there's no detox. There's only the county hospital, and the only place, you can only take him down there, and I used to go on 12-step calls down there all the time. They had a couple beds they had reserved under this Hill-Burton Act of Congress for indigent people with alcoholism, but they made you wait like 6 or 8 hours to get a guy in there. I mean, it was torture, and I don't want to go. I'm driving down there. In my head, I'm just bitching, you know. How come I got to do this stuff, all my problems? I'm the only one in Alcoholics Anonymous that does any service around here. You know, I'm just surly. I got to get up for work in a couple hours. Where's the miracle that everybody else is getting, you know? I get into the waiting room, and they make us wait and wait and wait. And I'm getting this guy orange juice, and I'm putting sugar in it there from a coffee thing there. And I'm giving him cigarettes, and he's talking to me, and he's telling me about how ashamed of himself he is for how the things he'd done to his mom and his dad. And I felt exactly like that when I came to AA. And he was telling me how he'd been a chronic relapser in Alcoholics Anonymous for several years, and he felt so hopeless because why should he even bother to get sober because he knows he's going to drink again? And that's exactly the way I felt in 1978 when I got sober. And he told me about wanting to commit suicide, but being afraid that he would screw it up and being afraid to do that. And I felt exactly like that. And something inside of him reached out and grabbed a hold of something inside of me. And they finally admitted him into the hospital after several hours, and I'm driving home, and I'm bawling like a baby because I finally understood it, that God will relieve me of the bondage of self with people like that over and over and over and over. At that moment, driving home from that hospital, I felt more whole, more complete, more perfect about my life and about me than I've ever felt in my whole life, except for maybe 5 or 10 minutes at when I was 12 years old and I just had about this much whiskey. See, alcohol relieved me of the bondage of self. 5 shots of whiskey in a bar, no matter how locked up I was inside of me, and I could come out and play. I could be free. And you do the same thing. Just to the extent that I show up and make myself available to you and to the new guys and do the actions that are against my thinking, that are against what a selfish, self-centered person who likes to just be wrapped up in themselves would like to do, and put me aside and abandon me and leave my life alone and show up and try to help God's kids. In direct proportion to that, God takes care of me and showers me with a greatness and abundance. My life has never been better. I think there's something here in Alcoholics Anonymous that this just defies logic. While I'm leaving my life alone and I'm going out and I'm trying to help God's kids, God comes in and does things for me that I could not do for myself. And if you're new, I want to welcome you. And I hope with everything in me that you will hang around here long enough to make a connection through a set of seemingly useless actions to a power source that will transform your life. See, AA for guys like us has good news and bad news. The good news is that Alcoholics Anonymous is an effective treatment for the inside emptiness of alcoholism. The bad news is that it doesn't work as fast as 5 shots of tequila. Thank you.